First item on the agenda is audience participation. William Mackey?
Behind you.
Sir, you have the podium.
I don't know if I'll need the podium. You can all hear me, right?
No.
You go on report. All right, in your agenda, you have a printout.
Says Transportation for America, T4 America, an alliance of businessmen, government, etc. A nice blue picture in there. It says news. Utah went and passed their own initiative. We cut off the bottom part of that printout from the email. The next article down said a dithering Congress. I think we know that. Elections are coming up. I'm not happy with either house, either party. So I'm bringing that to your attention that that's what happened at Utah. If the roads are good enough, you can drive down to Columbus and talk to your representative down there. I'm not saying the weather's bad. I'm just saying if the roads are good enough to drive on. So we could take local action to take care of funding like Utah did. Utah's got a smaller population, got a lot of roads. We got a larger population, and of course, we got a lot of roads and a lot of traffic. So I bring that to the policy committee's attention as a member of the CIC. Role of government, provide for the common good, provide roads, provide defense. Let's stay on the roads. I drive them a lot. I'm going to go on vacation here. I'm going to be driving around the eastern U.S. I'll let you know what I see. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Mr. Davis, University of Akron.
Yes.
Thank you, sir.
Good afternoon. My name is Andy Davis. I am with the University of Akron. I just wanted to introduce myself. I'm the Active Transportation Coordinator. It's a grant-funded position there to assist with bike and pedestrian initiatives, also to help with safe routes to school. A large part of the funding is from the Ohio Department of Transportation. Thank you to the Akron Public School Safe Routes to School program. But I also, there's some grant funding from Summit County Public Health to assist communities with development of complete streets or safe routes to school or active transportation projects. So I just wanted to bring that to your attention, make you aware that I'm someone that is available to help out and consult. We have been engaging in a couple of the communities already with these kind of things. And then finally, I wanted to give you a save the date. There will be a workshop coming up November 10th. It's a Tuesday right before Veterans Day. That will be at Summit County Public Health District on developing public streets policies. And it's meant to be a very hands-on workshop. Where, you know, one, you can be introduced and learn about that if you don't know about it already, but we really want to move it forward and try to help people draft policies at that. So it should be very productive, be available. It's also CBUs for those that need it. But that's going to be on Tuesday, November 10th, and hope to see you there. And if you need to get in touch with me, I'll forward my contact information to AMS, and they can put it out there for you as well. Thank you.
What is the location?
It'll be at the Summit County Public Health District office over there on West Market Street, behind the Act Number 1. Thank you.
Next item on the agenda is minutes from the May 14, 2015 meeting. This will require a motion.
Second.
Motion and second. Any discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Same. Thank you. Staff reports.
Jason. Okay, thanks, Mr. Chairman. Attachment 3A is the first staff report. That's our financial progress report. Between this meeting and the last meeting, we did have the end of the fiscal year, which was June 30th into July 1st. So this progress report takes us through the first month of the new fiscal year. We're right where we should be budget-wise. If you look at line 10 at the bottom, we've expended 8% of the budget. So we're right on track. We did close out fiscal 15, which is the year that ended on June 30th. Right where we should be as well. We actually carried over around $50,000 or $60,000 into this fiscal year, which we can then use. So we're in real good shape financially. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer those. Otherwise, we recommend approval.
Questions? Motion?
So moved.
Second. Motion heard and seconded. Any discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same. Motion carries. Technical progress report. Curtis, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a couple things on the federal and state level. First of all, the federal level, some discussion has been taking place about a long-term bill, which was kind of carryover from the last time when the Senate did extend with the House, extended MAP 21 out to October 31st. Unfortunately, though, those discussions are not very optimistic about anything long-term. If any of you watched the debate last night, you did see some discussion about a government shutdown potentially in the next 2 weeks at the end of September. Luckily for federal highway funds, that does not impact those funds at this time, so that would not result in delays. The date that we would need to worry about would be the end of October when the transportation bill would actually expire. I did reach out to the central office of ODOT, and their policy is that they do believe there will be a short-term fix, so there's no cause for panic. From the state perspective, I did want to let you know that there's Ohio's Research Initiative for Locals, which is also ORIL. Basically, through ODOT does research on transportation issues. They are currently asking for proposals from local governments or MPOs on any sort of research project you might be interested in. You know, specifically, things that have been in the past have been, you know, doing studies on new types of pavement or potentially looking at, you know, different styles of guardrails, new design, that kind of thing. Basically, engineering components to value engineer them, make them better, more cost-effective, et cetera. If you are interested, you can either reach out to them yourselves or come to us and we can get you in contact with them. Finally, on the local level, as many of you hopefully have been getting our emails, we do have on October 16th the MATS annual meeting. Keynote speaker will be Representative Frank LaRose. We'll also have James Hardy from the Summit County Public Health Department and new ODOT District 4 Director Alan Beal. We do think it'll be a great event. Again, it's on Friday, October 16th at the Sheridan, our usual place. And we're really looking forward to it. So you can register for that online. Just go to ametsplanning.org and you'll find the link to the registration, as well as there's a link with the emails that we've been sending out the last few weeks. Last couple things. At the last meeting after TAC and Policy Committee, we did discuss potentially starting some kind of subcommittee that would look at local funding issues for transportation outside of the usual discussion from the federal level. To this point, I've really only had one volunteer to stand on such committee. If there is any interest, if not, we would probably let it rest. But if there is any interest from anyone to serve on the subcommittee of the policy committee looking at transportation funding issues, you can please let me know or send an email as we're trying to put that together. And then on a final note, you know, we are looking to get our Connecting Communities planning grants started again. One of the things we're doing is we are going to start reaching out to our Connecting Communities Task Force to convene them this fall to evaluate the program, see if we need to do what kind of changes we need, look at the budget that we have, et cetera. But we're hoping that this winter, whether it be late 2015 or early 2016, we would actually be able to go out potentially for projects. So that is getting underway. If you have more interest in that, including serving on the task force, also please let me know. But if there are any questions, I can have an answer.
Seeing no questions. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
3C, AMETS Federal Funds. Victor?
Thank you. As was mentioned, fiscal year 2015 ended at the end of June, and on our table, you can see there's a number of projects that were covered in that fiscal year, and if you look at back to the table, you can see we have a resulting balance of about $1.7 million. We have roughly $16 million in project expenditures. So that $1.7 million is made up of SDPC matching and transportation alternatives funds, and those balances are well below the thresholds that ODOT set for MPOs for a lot of the fair workers. So that amount goes into 16. If you look at 16, we already had some encumbrances, but you'll see that we are short approximately $700,000 with the projects that are in that column right now. And as you look at 16, you'll see that there's a number of projects that were moved out. And if you'll recall, when we were developing the TIP earlier this year, we had to do that in order to be financially constrained for the requirements of the TIP. So again, without those projects in 16, we're short $700,000. Cumulative total of those that were moved out is about $5 billion. Those that were moved back in, we'd be short $5.7 billion. So the CAC TIP subcommittee met in August. This is one of the issues that they discussed. What we plan to do then is in December, maybe June timeframe, we'll get together, see what projects are left in this fiscal year, how much funding is left, to see which projects they funded, and then which ones will have to move to 17 or to 18. Depending on their schedule. In the meantime, we'll continue to look for trading funds with another MPO. As we mentioned before, that's becoming more and more difficult to do. MPOs in Ohio are getting a lot better at spending down their balances, and any funds that do have, they're kind of reserved and trading goes off. And as part of that, too, the subcommittee then made the decision to forego the annual 15% increase for 16, again, because the funds are not available. And then just two other things to mention. The hard copies of the TIP, the new TIP, are out at the table on the hallway. If you'd like to pick one up. And then also an email went out, just a reminder that the payment condition ratings were done by ODOT in 14 are complete, and we have a map loaded with those new PCR numbers up on our website. So if you have any questions, I'll be happy to
answer. Questions? Seeing none, thank you. Move on to old business, which I believe there's none. So new business, the traffic crash technical memorandum, Dave.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The 2012-2014 MX crash report is attachment 5A in your packet. During my presentation today, I'm going to look at trends over the 3 years. We'll look at which crash sections and intersections rank high. We'll review the ODOT safety program, and then we'll talk about pedestrian and bicycle crashes. Unfortunately, in 2014, crashes were up a little bit. I had 623 more crashes in 14 than in 13. I tried to rationalize why that happened. The only evidence I could come up with is vehicle miles traveled were up a little bit also, and that might account for some of it. Also, we had a couple bad winters, and I'm sure that also added to that increase. Injuries stayed almost the same. They were up slightly. And fatalities, fortunately, are decreasing. They came down each of the 3 years. When we sort out the high crash locations, we have to apply some criteria to the data. For roadway sections, it's 10 crashes per mile per year, and a crash rate of 1. For intersections, it's a crash rate of 1 and 10 crashes in the 3-year period. After we sort out the high crash locations, we need to rank them. We rank them on a composite score. A composite score takes into account the number of crashes, the crash rate, and the severity index. This is a more balanced approach to ranking a location. There were 124 highway sections that met the minimum criteria. Those are listed in Table 1 in the crash memo. Looking at the top 5, the first 3 are in Akron. Exchange Street from Rhodes to Dart, and that's actually this section right here. It's a one-way street, and there's a lot of crashes that happen in this curb lane for some reason, a lot of side swipes. Fortunately, there is a safety funds award and a project plan for that section. Manchester Road from Carnegie to Waterloo, Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard, or State Route 59 from Market Street to North Broadway. Over in Portage County, Ravenna Township, State Route 1444 from 59 to State Route 5, and then in Cuyahoga Falls, Powell Avenue from Main Street, from the Port Line to Main Street, and most of those happen right there near the State Route 8 interchange. There were 275 intersections that met the minimum criteria. Those are Table 2 in the memo. The number one ranked intersection was East Talmadge Avenue and Britton Road in Akron. Number 2 was East Market Street and Montevideo Road, which is also the I-76 eastbound ramp. Number 3 is Waterloo Road and Canton Road. Fortunately, there is a project plan for that intersection. Maple Street and Rhodes. And 5th was Waterloo Road and George Washington Boulevard. Freeways are evaluated by ODOT. They're done out of their central office in Columbus. They separate them into rural and urban. They analyze 1/10 of a mile section, and they only consider statewide the top 50 in each category. 6 locations were ranked in our area in the top 50. 2 of those were on the Ohio Turnpike, and the other 4 are on page 3 in the diagram on page 3. The ODOT safety program is one of the best in the country and also the largest. They spend over $100 million on safety projects, and that money is available for any public road. I must say that I feel very fortunate to be able to analyze this data in Ohio, because they're also very good at providing data and letting us look at data and crash reports. Applications are due in the central office on April 30th and September 30th, and you should have those into the district at least 6 weeks earlier. Funding is available for studies, design, and right-of-way, typically $50,000 all the way up to $5 million, and possibly even more if it's warranted. And the local match is usually 10%, so a really good deal. I'd like to make a little diversion here. I usually never talk about animal crashes. We usually take those out of the data because we've always felt there's not too much we can do about those, and really there isn't. But I did want to mention them this time because there were 2,367 deer crashes in the 3 years analyzed. That was 4% of the crashes. And there were 97 injuries, and the average claim for a deer crash was close to $4,000. And I really want to mention that because the peak season is coming up in our area. The peak season is in October and November, and I'm beginning to see, more and more deer wandering around. And the two times a day when they're most active is between 6 and 7 in the morning, and then 6 and 7 in the evening. And then they're pretty active throughout the evening. So there's really not much we can do about this, but I just wanted to make you aware. I think awareness is probably about the only thing that you can do to curb these type of accidents. Bicycle and pedestrian crashes have some unique characteristics. They have a lot of injuries, 81% and 88% respectively. They're more random and spread out. It's much more difficult to pinpoint exact locations. Many involve children and young people. When we start doing this research and looking at these crashes, what you see is a lot of times it's the bike riders, pedestrians, and the drivers that are not obeying rules that they should need to follow. And that's why education is probably a very effective countermeasure with these type of crashes. 2014 bicycle crashes are down. That's good news. There were 21 fewer crashes, 23 fewer injuries. Unfortunately, 2 fatalities. Those both happened in 2014. Total of 389 for the 3-year period, and 81% of those involved in injury. This is the age. This is a graph that shows the age of the bike riders involved in crashes. If you apply a rolling average trend line to that, you can see that most of the bike crashes are people that are less than the driving age. It kind of trends to the left of age 16. It peaks again a little bit later here in the 40s, and I couldn't quite figure that out, but it does have a little peak there. Most of the bike crashes happen at intersections, actually 2/3 of them do. Looking at the reports, a lot of times bike riders don't obey stop signs or traffic signals. And also, many times cars pull out in front of bikes. They don't see them, and that happens a lot at intersections also. There are considerably less non-intersection ones, and then a few at driveways. This is a police report that I saved. I saved this because it kind of involved a lot of elements to kind of make it the perfect storm, per se. As you can see, the bike rider is on the sidewalk, and then he's riding against traffic. You have bushes here, so that makes it hard for this car to see the bike rider approaching. And then he pulls up and he hits the bike rider, and then he leaves the scene. So that's kind of had a lot of what you see in many of the reports, all in one report. Pedestrian crashes, they stayed about the same. The number of crashes and injuries, they were relatively stable. 464 over the 3-year period. 88% of those involved in injury, and unfortunately 10 fatalities. This is the age. This is the graph of the ages of pedestrians involved in crashes. Once again, if you apply the trend line, you can see that unlike bike crashes, which tended to peak to the left of the driving age, these tend to peak to the right of the driving age. And it seems like the teens and the early 20s had involved people in pedestrian crashes. They happen basically everywhere at intersections and mid-block. Once again, at intersections, a lot of times cars turned, didn't see the pedestrian, ran into them, or they pedestrians were crossing against the signal. Mid-block crashes, most of them, it was a pedestrian darting out into traffic. There were a lot of different reasons, and then, of course, some happened at driveways. And many of the bike and pedestrian crashes that happened at driveways involved people in a hurry, people backing out and just not taking the time to look like they should have. So, concluding, crashes were up a little bit. Injuries and were about the same, and then fatalities down. All the locations in the tables are available for ODOT safety funding, and also these locations are eligible for points when we start funding projects, when we start scoring projects, and just this year I think we actually changed the point structure, so you actually can get now a few more points if your location is on one of our crash lists. These locations will be sorted by community on our website, so you can just look at your own community and see what's happening there. AMETS recommends that when you do plan your projects, include pedestrians and bicycles and the safety of those modes of transportation. Bicycle crashes were down, pedestrian crashes stayed about the same, and feel free to contact us if you have any questions about the report as a whole or a specific location. And that concludes my presentation. If there's any questions, I'd be glad to try to answer them.
Any questions?
Yes.
I just had two locations on the intersection list that I think could use some clarification. One is rank number 103 on the intersection list where it says Summit County, Coffee Township. That intersection is either controlled by Acton or Fairlawn. Not sure which, but it's in both, so maybe we just want to add Acton and Fairlawn there. Sometimes people look down these lists and they look at the rural community and they just kind of skip by it and miss it. One other one's farther down the list, all the way down at 230 Cleveland Massa Road, the Ridgewood Road, that's also part of Fairlawn, so we could add Fairlawn to that as well.
I think that was a little clarification.
Okay.
I'll clarify that.
Thanks, sir.
Any other questions or comments? I'd like a motion to accept the report.
Make a motion.
Mr. Green? Yes, sir. Motion made and second. Any discussion? Hearing no discussion. All in favor?
Aye.
All opposed? Motion carries. Thanks, Dave. Nice job. Draft pedestrian plan for discussion only. Krista.
Hi, thank you. I just want to give a brief update on where we are. We started developing the 2015 pedestrian plan. This is an update to the one we did in 2012. It's a major input into our upcoming regional transportation plan. Three of the main goals that we're looking at are how to increase safety, connectivity, and increasing the whole network, and also looking at how to encourage pedestrian-friendly design. So the plan will include a lot of examples and strategies at looking at all of these things and how we can incorporate those into AMS and into our communities. It will also include an updated sidewalk inventory. Right now, we are just drafting it, and we're looking for input on things that you'd be interested in, things that we should include or look at, or kind of things that you think are examples for our communities. So I'd be happy to take any comments now, or feel free to email me or call me if you have any kind of questions. We'll be getting a draft out in the next month or two, and we'll send that to everybody, and then we'll be looking for approval in December. So that's all I have, and I'd be happy to answer any questions or if you have any comments at this time.
Questions or comments?
All right, thank you.
Thank you. 3C, demographic profile presentation. Curtis.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As many of you know, as part of the planning process, one of the things we try to do is
continue to do a demographic analysis of our area. And we find it really helps when we look at our transportation issues, understanding some of our transportation issues. Recently, the 2013 American Community Surveys data came out by the tract level. So what we've done is kind of put together a series of maps to show all of you some of the trends that we're seeing and maybe some of the transportation issues that go along with those. It's going to start, and just for a frame of reference, usually gray is the lowest, red is the hottest in terms of sort of how the scaling goes in all these, and we did it like that so you could actually see them via the projector. So hopefully that will work. The first thing that we really look at is population density, and what the population density map shows is how many people live, or how many people per square mile live in a certain tract. And this is kind of important to see where our current density exists in our region, as well as sort of where the density does not. Some of our highest dense or densest areas in the region are Kent State University there, that tract that's part of Kent State, as well as the tract that's just south of Ohio Polytechnic University, also known as the University of Athens. Is that too soon for that joke? that's where we see the highest level of density. Lowest level of density, which is 72 people per square mile. I don't know if anybody wants to take a guess, or I'll just tell you it's the Arsenal or the townships around the Arsenal over here. It's very low density. The other area with low density is around the National Park, the tract that includes a lot of Boston Township and a little piece of, actually I think it's all just the township. Obviously, density is important, especially when we talk about transit. It's a lot easier for transit service to serve people in denser areas. Typically, we see our transit service functioning the best in our more dedicated urban areas, like in areas of Akron and KSU. It also can kind of impact when we look at funding things, you know, what's going to be the greatest impact and what's the most utility that we get out of a project. So when we're thinking about trails, sidewalks, et cetera, you know, what kind of use are we going to get, you know, out here versus in here? It's just another factor that we look at. The next slide is sort of the more hipster slide. This is the 18 to 24-year-olds. This is a lot of times, if you can imagine, kids are about to go into school or in school or just out of school. Millennial age students, it's a very important demographic. It's also an interesting one from the transportation implications demographic, considering that, as many of you know, in the insurance world, if you're under 25, you're a lot more expensive to insure. Statistically, you're a more dangerous driver, more chances of distracted driving. We also have more transit users and more bike and ped users in this area. And again, what we see is the blocks around Akron U as well as Kent State. Even Hiram pops out more than a lot of the areas around it. And the Valley are areas of high demographics for the 18 to 24-year-olds. Another interesting thing is that if you really don't want to live by the 18 to 24 demographic, your best choice is either right here in Norton, which has less than 2% of the people living there between the ages of 18 and 24, as well as this portion of Cuyahoga Falls, which is also under 2%. Just to give you a frame of reference, in the Kent and University of Akron area, it's almost 90% of the people living there are between the ages of 18 and 24. So talking about very dense areas of young students. On the flip side, looking at 65 and over, I think even the perception of a 65-year-old now versus, you know, 50 years ago is probably a lot different. But also, I think the narrative's changed, because even 10 years ago, I think there was more of a thought of that, you know, there's all these older people staying in their homes and, you know, the city of Akron or the city of Barberton, and they don't want to leave. But now what we're seeing is this is really, as the baby boomers age, we're seeing that a lot of a higher density, higher percentage of people over 65 are actually out in the suburbs. High concentrations in the Fairlawn areas of Cuyahoga Falls, formerly Northampton. You can see it in Aurora, as well as Talmadge. Mayor Klein, I believe that your tract is the has the highest percentage. I think 27% of the people that live in that tract are over 65. You've got you're the winning tract on that, so congratulations. Some of you know, too, again, with transit, one of the things we have to worry about with things like on-demand service, you know, as we have a more elderly population, eventually aren't able to drive as often or as easily to things like doctor's appointments. get groceries, et cetera. And this really presents a challenge, I think, on the on-demand transit service, because trying to serve an entire county with, say, a Metro RTA or taxi cab service, et cetera, and similar with Portage County, gets very expensive very quickly. So this is sort of, I think, a trend that really from a transportation system, we'll have to kind of see how it bears out. Again, and then inversely, the university area is only about less than 3% of the people living in those university tracts in Akron, U, and Kent State are over 65. So there you kind of see the inverse of each other. Here is the percent non-white population. Kind of the most interesting thing, I think, is more in the Twinsburg area, where we've seen a lot of population coming down from southeast Cleveland, Bedford, Maple Heights, Garfield Heights, working its way down. Twinsburg Township and Twinsburg have roughly about 43% minorities in that tract that's brown. In Akron, some of these areas of Akron on the west side are almost 100% minority. I think the highest is 98.5%. And then obviously you can see the areas of gray and light blue are areas of have very low percentage of minorities. Some even statistically a zero in southeast Portage County. Doesn't necessarily no one means that no one in the minority lives there, but it's not statistically significant. What we kind of move on to here is household size. And household size for our area is about 2.5 people per household. Nationally, this has been a pretty big issue because national household size has been shrinking since 1960. About 3.3 people live per household. Now it is 2.54 nationally. So our area is actually even a little bit smaller than the average in terms of household size. And similarly, what's interesting, especially in transportation, is that while we have smaller households, it also has meant that we have more households. So what you see is that, well, you have maybe a lot more one-parent families or, just smaller sizes, you still typically have one or two cars per household. So we actually can see, even though the households are smaller, we see more trips, more cars on the road. I think just to point out, some of the largest areas of household size are up here in Hudson, north of the Turnpike. And then in some of the townships in Portage County, they're about 3.25 people per household, which is almost like it was in 1960. Areas of New Franklin rank above the average, as well as areas south of Ripon. But we do see, especially in the downtown area and a lot of places, or in the urban area in Akron, that the household sizes are shrinking pretty dramatically. One interesting little tidbit to note going back to the universities is that at Akron, what we're seeing is that there must be a lot of students shacking up together in houses because the household size in that little teeny block just south of Akron is close to three people per house. But we don't see that kind of playing out the same in that Kent State area. I think it's because it's more dorms, apartment living than, say, house rentals. But so those types of statistics really do sort of pop up on this map, which make it interesting to analyze. And then this kind of plays on that is just percents of households with children. In Hudson, Richfield, Stowe, and Twinsburg have some of the highest percentages of households with children. Hudson, in some of those blocks, has almost 50% of the households have children. Twinsburg, in its highest block, the ones in the red, have about 44%. Stowe has 40%. In that block near that Calls Farm development off of Fish Creek there. But then you see on the other side of the coin is sort of where we have some public housing or large chunks near the air dock. That stands out as well as an area that has a high amount of children per household. Moving towards percent bachelor's degree, this is sort of interesting. What we've started to see is there's almost a line, not quite exactly, but the 76 corridor. You see the education levels are substantially higher in the northern part of the county versus, or Summit County versus the southern, and that even reflects a little bit more on the Portage side as well. The average for a track is about 25% of the people hold a bachelor's degree. The Hudson area is the highest, 78% of residents hold a bachelor's degree or higher. Copley and Bath, these tracks right here, are about 63%. The lowest are these areas of Akron here, and as well as this area of Ripon, which is less than 5% of the bachelor's degree. What's interesting is that then we flip this to the median household, you can see that there's not exactly a correlation between income and education level. Anything that's in green on this map is actually more than the average, or more than the median income. The average more than the median income. So the median income in our area is about $50,000. Anything in green, the median income is about $55,000. So what you see is while still there are some areas that have a higher median income, I believe that block in Hudson that we keep going back to is about $152,000. We definitely see more of a mix in our two and a half county area, as well as you see kind of the rural economy flourishing in the southeast Portage portion of the county as well, of Portage County. One thing we want to do then kind of put this is then looking at it per capita. So instead of looking at it just by the track, we're looking at kind of per person, how much money is there per person. Again, per person in those tracks of Hudson, are rough. The average is $24,000. The highest one in this area of Hudson is $68,000 per person in that area of Hudson, which is definitely the highest. We also, what I think is also sort of interesting is you see how where some of these areas that when we looked at income did pretty well, when we do per capita, they don't show up as well because these are also areas that have higher household sizes. So they make more, they make a better living, but they're also trying to support more children in most cases. And that's, I think, what goes back to even that Hudson example, is Hudson also has one of the largest household sizes in those blocks, and is still pouring the highest numbers of income. So it's kind of just an interesting area where we don't see. Also, Silver Lake does very well, or very high in this category, greater than almost $50,000 per person. Same with Copley and Bath areas on the west side of Summit County. Percent of renter-occupied housing units. This one really kind of just shows, I think, what a lot of people probably already know. There are a lot of rental units, percentage-wise, in the downtown area, in the university areas. But what also pops out is public housing, as well as some of the kind of core apartment areas in our region. So, you know, this area of Steele's Corners, where we have quite a few multifamily units, pops out, areas around Kent, and again, the Valley, those areas are more highly rented. But then what you see, too, is that in the bulk of the area, really we're talking about most units being owner-occupied and very few rental units in these communities. So the last one I just wanted to show you was, this is homes built in or before 1960. So it shows the percentage of homes that were built basically before 1960. This is sort of important from the standpoint that usually 1960 seems to be the turning point in terms of where we started seeing more of the suburban style development. So areas with more color are typically going to correspond with what we know as being a little bit more urban, more pedestrian friendly, more likely to have a grid system. The oldest tract in terms of housing, around Lake Anna in Barberton, 98.5% of the homes were built before 1960. So it's quite an infrastructure responsibility there when it comes to that. A lot of Akron area is about more than 75%. And then on the other side of the coin, you have the northern area of Stowe, only has about 2% of homes were built before 1960. Green's about 13%. The whole Montrose area really developed after 1960 is that's about 9% in terms of built before 1960. So this map kind of also pulls out some of the more urban areas, as you'll see even Ripon sort of pops up as a community that has a lot of the older homes or a higher percentage of older homes. So this, in a way, if you remember our Connecting Communities initiative, we did planning areas. This sort of mirrors that in terms of how our communities have developed over time. So with that, I'll conclude, but I just wanted to say that you know, this demographic data, as it comes out, we continue to process it, continue to map it. It is on our website. We use it to develop the long-range plan. Really, if your community is interested in diving deeper in any of this data, we'd be happy to help you. Our GIS coordinator, Seth Bush, is really good at uncovering this stuff and mapping it, so we'd be happy to work with you on that. But if there are any other questions, that concludes my presentation.
questions? Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Next item is resolution 2015-11, item 6A in our packet today.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So this is the CMAP funding program. The table that's attached to this memo and resolution. This is a list of projects that were submitted from our area this year for the statewide CMAP funding program. There were 13 projects. A little bit over $27 million. Much like last year, our TACTIF subcommittee used the scoring criteria in the statewide committee to score these projects, and you can see the total scores on the right there. And if last year is any indication, there'd be an opportunity, there's a good chance that we'd get the same amount of funds that we normally get, which is a little bit less than $5 million a year in CMAC funds. If that is the case, once we submit these down to Columbus, what that would do is bring us down to project number one and two, and then there'd be a couple hundred thousand left over to go, possibly go toward one of the four buses that part of this requested. And when we presented this last week at the TAC, part of did mention that we'd like to at least get one full bus funded, so that would be probably a couple hundred thousand more. And so there might be some opportunities to overprogram a little bit, and we'll present that when we go down to Columbus and get this list of projects. Again, this is for fiscal year 2021, and this resolution is to submit this list of prioritized projects out of the state.
Questions? Seeing no questions, we'll need a motion.
So moved.
Motion and second?
Second.
Motion and second. Discussion? All in favor? Opposed? Motion passes. 6B, resolution 2012-12, adopting the revised AMS funding policy.
So before we start a round of funding, first thing we do is we look at our policy to see if any changes need to be done. The TACTIF subcommittee did that. We talked about a busy meeting back in August. So the bullet points there in that memo are the main changes have been done. So after this memo and then the resolution, the third page will come to is changes. So on that third page, under general project eligibility, you can see there in red, up until this point, it's always been understood that you have to be a member of AMAP to apply for funding, but that's never really been written in policy, so we finally did that. The next page is our surface transportation program project evaluation criteria. The only change is there is that we simply wanted all of our individual programs to add up to 100. It's kind of easier to understand if you've got a certain number of points or chances of getting funded. So we changed the point structure, and then also, as you can see, some of the points got a little bit more, a little bit less than they did originally. Moving on to the next page is our transportation alternatives program. A little bit more changes there. On that first page is the policies. So in red there, the language is added so that feasibility study needs to be completed before getting awarded funding under this funding program. And the idea is there is just so that sponsors know better what alignments they're looking at, what the project is, and what the costs are. And then right in the middle of the page there where it says feasibility study must include the following, and there's three bullet points at the TAC last week. There was discussion on that first bullet point to modify the wording so that it now would read reasonable assurance that the preferred alternative preferred alignment conforms to ASHRAE standards. So that was the only change they recommended from what we're seeing now. And then down at the bottom of the page there, under program policies number four, upgrading, just a clarification, if sidewalks are eligible for funding, if they're existing sidewalks, it has to be going, for example, from a 4-foot sidewalk to an 8-foot sidewalk that allows for more modes.
can't simply fund the project. It's 4 feet wide. It needs upgraded to be another 4 foot wide sidewalk. It has to be upgraded to a wider width. The next page is the project evaluation criteria for the TAP program. It's changing up that we didn't show the existing, but yet it's still pretty similar. It has pretty much the same criteria, just clarification on what those criteria are as well. So for number one is facility, the type of facility. Number two is project type, or logical termini. Three, level of use, consistency of the plans. And then our last one, our fair share distribution. And again, these points add to what number. And then the next page is our resourcing program, and that would essentially just change so that the total points add up to 100. And the last page is our project selection flow chart. And as you can see, that first bubble is what we're in right now, with a view of our funding process in the August, September timeframe. So we'll be sending out an email shortly, starting the process once these funding policies provisions are approved. We'll start that process here shortly. Letter of intent will be due as the first step. Once we get those in, clear up any issues, we'll then submit applications. Those will be due sometime in the November timeframe. And then at that point, the subcommittee and the staff will score those applications. And then by January, we should have back to this committee which projects we think are recommended to get funded. So,
if anybody has any questions, you have any questions.
And this funding will be for 2021
and
2022.
Mr. Chairman, I'd just like to call the attention to this group. First of all, almost all of the actual policy changes, I think, are good and very helpful. That in the effort to make all of the scoring meet up to 100 points, I think inadvertently we may have been doing something here that we're not going to be happy with later for the surface transportation program. As I recall, much discussion, one of our goals was concentrate on preservation of existing. And by taking away in item number one, 5 points from preservation, we've really cut, it makes a big difference when you start to score. And I don't have any objection to getting to 100 points, but we've added points in other locations that maybe we don't need to. And at minimum, I would suggest that if we maintain the points in number one and cut back somewhere else so that we don't jeopardize our goal of emphasizing preservation of existing infrastructure. I don't know that we want to send this back to committee because of the schedule in the future, although I think we might be could have another meeting and just have this on the agenda. I could suggest a different scoring method here. We could all sit down here and scratch it out a little bit and still get to 100. But I just am opposed to taking away points for preservation when I think that we've got a lot of discussion that in the growth patterns of our region that need to emphasize preservation of our existing system above everything else. Any other folks want to add anything to that, or anybody agree with me? If not, why I'll shut up and move forward.
Comment?
Yeah, if I could just address that really quickly. The subcommittee did go back and forth quite a bit looking at these. And keep in mind, though, that this point structure is 100. It actually was reduced. It was originally 133 points. So this point being 20 points for preservation is 20%, which is about what it was originally. So we actually, even though the points went down, we also cut down on the overall number of points. So So we're at right about where we were originally. I don't have those exact numbers in front of me, but we went over that.
And just to add to that, Al, it's a good point, but I agree with Victor that one of the goals of the committee was there was a lot of discussion about keeping preservation as a high priority. So one other thing to add to what Victor said, there's actually a little more daylight percentage-wise now between, say, a preservation project and a capacity project. So the way the committee looked at it is, all things being equal, if you have a preservation project that also has a safety problem or is on a major road, you're always going to outpace a project that adds more capacity. So I think we kind of left that room at that committee feeling pretty confident we were maintaining the intent.
Well, I'm willing to watch how the projects get scored this next year and then bring it up again afterwards if we don't like how it's working out. The other thing that bothered me on it is on item 7 for complete streets, we're saying those 10 points are the discretion of staff. I don't know if we, you know, we have good staff.
Thank you.
But to me, I think that maybe staff recommends, but we can't get away from the policy committee having to approve those. We're going to give discretionary points. I just don't think you can turn around and say discretion of staff. It's just not an appropriate way for this body to function. Some change in that language, I think, is appropriate. I think that's the reason why the committee wanted to do that.
Do you want to address that, Victor? Do you want me to?
Well, we could vote to it, but I think that part of that was, you know, we would be looking at the applications that we initially, when we score these, we'll do it at a staff level, and then we bring that to the subcommittee level. So ultimately, they'll come up with it. They'll agree or disagree with us. Then we bring it to the tax and then the policy. So it starts at the staff level, but it goes to our committee before next year.
In the practical consideration we were trying to address, so before we kind of had a laundry list of complete streets, if you will, improvements, but you know, improved bus stops, bike lanes, sidewalks. Before it was very formulaic, so if you said you were doing a bike lane with your project, you automatically got 2 points for that. But what we found over the years reviewing these projects is sometimes I don't think intentionally to get more points, but people just kind of add in passing, oh yeah, we have a bike lane. But as it would come out and the project would get designed, the bike lane would fall off. Or so what our attempt here to do is really to kind of, if we see a sponsor saying we're doing sidewalks, bike lanes, we're planning on following up with them, where are the bike lanes going to go, what part of the project, what percentage, and then we're going to kind of try to gauge how significant of a complete streets project that is. And I think the intent is we'll report back to the TIP subcommittee on each one that gets these bonus points. We'll say we gave that project 5 points and here's why, and we'll kind of have a written summary of this is why we awarded it. And like Victor said, then at that point that committee, and we encourage them to do that, they can, if there are any issues where they don't agree with us, that's, they're within their rights to modify that scoring. Then it goes to TAC, and then it goes to all of you here. So we feel that we, although, yes, we'll take the first crack at awarding at these points, it's not, I wouldn't characterize it as discretionary points in the sense that we can just say, hey, we like that project better, we're going to give it a bonus.
That's why I think you've got to really be careful, because some of these communities get picky at what the language is. That's why we've made some changes already. I have no problem with staff looks at this and they say, hey, you know, this is not even going to be a continuous walkway or bikeway. It doesn't fit with anything. And so it's the recommendation of staff. That's great. That's what the whole thing should be that way. But kind of the way it's worded, it does sound like whatever staff says is the final word. And I don't know how to change that. Maybe it, as recommended by staff or something like that, might be a better word.
Oh, to replace at the discretion of staff with as recommended by staff to the TIP subcommittee
something
or
something like that.
Just maybe something that softens it a little bit where it doesn't sound like we're just dictating how many points.
Arbitrary.
I mean, we would...
It's determined by staff.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, we would, if that's amenable to the rest of the committee, we'd be happy to make that change just to, and you know, we'll come up with wording along those lines, or if somebody wanted to propose exact wording for that, we're open to that, too.
That's all the discussion.
Other questions? I know the chair is not supposed to ask a question, but just out of curiosity, we took points away from transportation, then we took off highway from item 7, and then we increased the points there. What was the rationale that came out of the TAP TIF to develop that?
Take off the points for freeway and expressway?
Well, it took highway, so if the definition is freeway and expressway, okay.
Well, we took that off generally. That would be ODOT applying to us for an interstate or something like that. So we didn't want to necessarily say, I don't think they ever have, not to say that it's not eligible, but it's never happened. So we took it off just to...
More aligned with the real world.
Well, and the other part of the rationale, too, was but just to be clear, it doesn't preclude freeways from applying. The freeways and expressways are technically also considered principal arterials. So if we were to get an application, say, for a freeway interchange or something, it would still be eligible. It would just, we'd call it a principal arterial. It was more to kind of just clean up the scoring.
How often do you change the arterial? Just go by traffic counts?
Oh, to classify them?
Yeah.
Every 10 years, we'll reevaluate the whole system, or as needed. Say there's a lot of development in the area and the traffic counts really went up. We have in the past amended our criteria more frequently than 10 years. But generally, every 10, we look at the whole system, and then that's where the decisions get recommended by this body to the state to change the official federal classification.
Does it not also include the federal?
Yeah, we'll work with ODOT. ODOT does a great job of categorizing that, but then Federal Highway Administration has to sign off. But we're only allowed a certain percentage of our roads to be arterials. I think they do that so everybody doesn't, you know, every road doesn't become an arterial. So.
That's at the discretion of the staff, right?
Well, our initial recommendation is at the discretion of the staff. But you guys still get to approve that, too. You're the Senate and House, and we're the executive branch.
Great.
But, well, yeah, not in that way.
And there's 400,000 people that are all part of the judicial staff that are going to tell us what we did wrong. Any other discussion? Thanks. Al? Need a motion?
I move to approve with the amendment on Section 7, Complete Streets, to replace at the direction of the staff that the staff may make recommendations up to 10 points.
Second.
So it would read, instead of the asterisk, all the discretion of the staff may make recommendations up to 10 points. Any clarification? Motion second made. Discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed, same? Thank you. Resolution 2015-13.
Attachment 16 in the packet. This memo discusses the staff budget expenditures for the fiscal year that just ended on June 30th. The purpose of the attached resolution is to approve the fiscal year 2015 year-end completion report so that we can transmit it to ODOT for the review. We do this annually, and we meet with ODOT in October in order to finalize the fiscal year. Within attachment 6C is a financial summary for all the work elements scheduled during the last fiscal year. In summary, the staff budget was approximately $1.6 million, with nearly that amount expended. The remainder, $16,400,
is available for this year's fiscal year's use through December 31st. A number of significant products and activities were accomplished during the last fiscal year, such as the allocation and management of federal funds, the development of the new FY 2016-2019 TLP, the traffic counting program, the high crash location report, participation in the statewide CMAC program, a mid-block pedestrian crossing analysis, a road diet analysis, and preliminary work on the upcoming 2040 regional transportation plan. All planning work for FY 2015 was completed, and expenditures were within the budgeted amounts. The staff and the TAC both recommend approval of resolution 2015-13. Are there any questions?
Seeing no questions, motion?
So moved.
Second?
Second.
Any discussion? No discussion. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed, same? Thank you. 6D in the packet, resolution 2015-14. It's an amendment.
Thank you. Resolution 2015-14 is Amendment 1 to our new 2016-19 TIP. This amendment adds six new projects and revises the funding to two. The six new projects that is being added is State Route 225, resurfacing in Deerfield Township, Portage County, State Route 8 Bridge, engineering only in Akron. That's the high-level bridge. I-76 Main Broadway Interchange building demolition in Akron. State Route 303 resurfacing in Peninsula and Boston Heights. I-480 resurfacing in Macedonia, Twinsburg, Twinsburg Township, and Hudson. And I-480 Noise Mall in Twinsburg. The two projects with funding being revised is Streetsboro Signal Upgrade with highway safety improvement funding being added to the engineering and runway phase. And the State Route 59 or Akron Interbelt rerouting, adding $2.5 million of bridge funds to that project.
Question.
I'm sorry, I got a couple of questions there. Are the highway safety funds going to Streetsboro? Is that a new source of funds or simply increasing safety funds they already have? And the same, I guess, question for the Akron project. Do they now get a grant for local bridge funds so they can add that, or are we increasing the amount of bridge funds?
Yeah. In Streetsboro, I believe those are new funds. The those are new funds that were granted by the ODOT Safety Funding Committee. And I'm sorry, what was the other project?
The Akron 59, where they are getting local bridge funding, and then I guess there's a decrease then in the NHTP funding that's probably coming because they got the local bridge funding, I'm presuming.
Yeah, that's also a new source of funding.
Okay.
Any other questions? Thank you. This will also require a motion.
Someone here.
Motion made. Dave. Second?
Second.
Second. John? Motion. Discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Same? Motion carries. Other business? We have to form the nomination committee for next year already.
I'll sit down with
all right, you just chair yourself and
we usually need one more committee.
It's usually a three-member committee, the chair and then two members.
Yeah, so
usually one third. It's like bridge. Any interest? Last time we did it by phone, so we have to read it. Bill? Okay. We have our nominating committees. I don't think that takes a motion. Anything for the good of the order?
We'll adjourn.
Second?
That was a quick
case. All in favor, say aye. Goodbye.
It's a nice day out there. Enjoy it.